So when the Chinese master, Yun Men, was asked by one of his students, what are the entire teachings of a lifetime's practice? He answered, an appropriate response. And in this rather pithy, direct little story, this koan, what we find Yun Men doing is trying to bring his student back from abstraction, from concepts and ideas, to the immediacy of his experience, to what's actually happening here and now, what's actually arising in the present moment. He's trying to shift us from that tendency we have to think about and conceptualize our experience in terms of, do I like it or don't I like it? Should it be like this or should it be like that? Am I right and you're wrong? And usually it's that way around, very rarely the other way. And trying to shift us back to this encounter with the immediacy of our experience. What's actually arising internally in that interior landscape of our own body-mind? What's arising externally in the environment and the world around us, which we're embedded within, we're an integral part of? And what's arising both internally and externally? So this sense that we co-create the present moment from internal and external conditions. And then to find an appropriate response to the situation we find ourselves in. And this practice that we've been doing, just asking what is this, is within that same vein. So you might remember the story that Martin told us about Huijiang and Huineng, and where this practice and this question comes from. How Huijiang travelled a great distance to meet this famous teacher he'd heard about, and he was brought in to see him. And we can imagine that on their meeting, Huineng asked him, who are you, where have you come from, how was your journey? And suddenly, Huineng pulls the rug out from underneath him. He shifts the tone, the tenor of the conversation. He turns to him and he says, but what is this thing? And how did it come to be here? And the ground falls out beneath the feet of Huijiang. He's left speechless. And what he's brought face to face with, what he encounters, is what the Chinese call the great matter of birth and death, what the Buddha referred to as dukkha, what we might call nowadays the human condition. That sense that we are really highly sensitive beings that are continuously impacted by a world of sights and sounds, tastes, smells, body sensations, thoughts, images, memories, and how we try to, if you like, turn the intensity of that down because we're so sensitive to it by trying to control our world, desperately trying to reject and get rid of those things that we find challenging and distressing, trying to hold on to those things that bring a sense of security, safety, a little happiness. And how, in a sense, we can't do this. We can't actually hold back and bring certainty to the shifting sands of our changing experience. So when we enter this practice, we're doing, as the Buddha said, we're actually swimming against the stream. We're cultivating qualities of the heart and mind, resources, a sensibility that actually brings us to turn to our experience, to become closer to it, to meet it and embrace it. and to find our way of responding to how it is in the moment. And when we ask this question, one of the things we talk about is that this encounter with the great matter of birth and death encompasses the whole of our being. And within the tradition, they talk about asking the question with the 360 bones and the 84,000 pores of the body, that the whole of our being is engaged with it. And they have this image of the question as a sword, a sharp sword, that cuts through our thinking, that cuts through our tendency towards abstraction, and brings us back to the immediacy of the moment. So, as Martine and Katrin have already pointed out, an important aspect of this questioning is the not knowing. And in the tradition, they talk about live words and dead words. So, is the question alive for us? Does it have a vividness? Are we actually asking a question about something we actually don't know the answer to? And at times there can be a way in which there's a sense that the question mark at the end of the question kind of falls off the words. It becomes a dead question. There's no life to it. And what can really help is a cultivation of this sense of not knowing. A cultivation of what one Korean teacher calls the don't know mind. And one way we can do this in our practice, in our meditation, is to actually explicitly acknowledge we don't know. So from time to time, we might ask the question, wait a few moments, and then say silently to ourselves, I don't know. And again, tune into how does that feel as a felt sensation in the body-mind? How does that ripple through the body-mind when we really acknowledge that we don't know, that something about this life is questionable, is deeply perplexing? And as part of this not knowing, what we find in the tradition, particularly the early tradition when it was at its most creative, is this wariness, this mistrust of views and opinions, of truths. This sense that our views and opinions colour how we perceive the world, often in very unhelpful ways. So a professor came to meet a Japanese master called Nan In. And after they had greeted each other, they sat down at a low table to have a cup of tea. So Nan In served the tea, pouring the tea into the cup of the professor. And once it reached the top, he kept pouring. The professor watched the cup overflow into the saucer and onto the table, and when he could no longer restrain himself, he blurted out, "It's over full, no more will go in." "Like this cup," Nan In said, "you are full of your own opinions and speculations. How can I show you Zen unless you first empty your cup?" So there's an invitation in this question to suspend our views and opinions, at least for the moment of immediacy when we come back, to open to a new possibility, to actually create the sense or the space for something unexpected to arise, something we've never known before. For the moment itself to be a fresh moment. That we're cultivating this wide open awareness where we reject nothing and we hold on to nothing, where everything has a sense of freshness. And again, within these traditions, they talk a lot about beginner's mind, this sense that actually we come to each moment fresh and new. And you may have noticed, some of you, particularly if you've been around Buddhist circles for quite some time, that when you ask this question, particularly initially, what starts to come up are all the very good Buddhist answers you already know around emptiness or not self or whatever it might be. That we're actually, in a sense, just conceptualizing things we already know, rather than opening to this fresh new moment and what it might disclose to us, rather than overlaying it with what we perceive it to be, turning down the intensity of it. So as we ask this question, what we encounter, as we've talked about already, is impermanence, uncertainty, groundlessness, but also conditionality. And I remember reading many years ago a book called A Short History of Everything by Bill Bryson, where he talked about the improbability that any of us are actually born and alive, that the chain of causation over time that has had to have unfolded for us to be here, right now, is beyond comprehension. And I remember him saying, talking about the little mammal that's part of our evolutionary chain that somehow escaped being a dinosaur's lunch and didn't get destroyed in the extinction event that killed off the dinosaurs. The improbability that all our ancestors, our great-great-great-grandmothers, grandparents, grandfathers, actually met each other, got together and decided to have a family and lived long enough to bring that family up. And all of this wave of causation that goes back billions of years, from the Big Bang and before onwards, that arrives in this moment with us right here now, with this person designated Tony sitting up here making strange noises with its vocal cord that go through these wires and through the ether, hit your ears and make sense to you. And there's a way in which we take that so for granted. It's kind of like that's just how it is. But this question brings us round to maybe see that in a new way, to be astonished by the fact that any of this is happening at all. That anything, any little change in that wave of conditionality might mean that I wasn't here, might mean that none of us were here, that none of this actually existed, none of this would happen. So part of this question is this astonishment at the sheer mystery of life. Of not covering it with this sense of, that's just how it is. Familiarity as our way of controlling and toning down the intensity of the raw experience of the moment. So another aspect of this question is also what Catherine was talking about today, this listening, but also waiting. listening is a different orientation to this question. We tend to, as a species, privilege sight. We navigate our way through life, principally through sight. And a lot of the metaphors we use are based around sight. So we talk about seeing deeply into. We talk about insight, about observing. When I first came to practice, you don't hear it so much now, they talked about watching the breath, watching the body. And there's very much a way in which this sense of looking, of seeing, of sight, has this element of searching, of going out to. And when we change the orientation to listening, there's an orientation towards receiving, about opening and just allowing life to arise, to receive the present moment. So when we listen, we can listen to the question. And we can also listen for a response. Not as an answer, but as a sense of waiting, of that possibility of the unexpected arising, the freshness of the moment. That we wait for this response. So there's this sense of just waiting without expectation for a response that may never come, but just that sense of waiting to receive life. And what we might start to find is actually the question itself is the response. That open awareness, receiving the whole of the moment in a fresh new way, in its own unique, never to happen again sense, is the response. And it's important, as I talk about this, to really emphasize we're not looking or chasing after any particular state. We're not looking for any particular experience. We're very much here cultivating a particular sensibility, an orientation and its perspective of the mind, so that we perceive the world through this perspective. We perceive the world as questionable. We perceive the world as a sense of wonder, a sense of mystery. We perceive it as uncertain. And this informs how we receive and experience the moment. So really, there's the invitation to play a bit with this question, to play with the listening, the not knowing, and to explore it, to investigate the question. And sometimes the question may shift in a way to, in a sense, turning back on itself. I remember Stephen, Martine's husband, many years ago, talking about how the question shifted to him for a while to being a question of what is this thing that asks, what is this? For me, at some points it's kind of turned back to what is this that knows? Or what is this that knows this? And that sense of perplexity around that sense of is it the this that knows any different from the this that is known? But again, here it's important that if the question does shift back on itself, if it does shift in a way that's kind of drawing you, that it's not too specific, but also that it is staying as a question, that it's not becoming an intellectual or philosophical investigation, that it's still cultivating this sense of not knowing of perplexity, of wonder, of mystery. So what we're doing in this practice of questioning is we're cultivating these attitudes and these qualities of the mind-heart, this resourcing, so that we can meet the whole of the moment from a particular orientation, with a particular kind of framework, a particular colouring, as of it being questionable, it being perplexing, there being something that we don't quite know about it, a sense of wonder, a sense of mystery. And these are all different kind of flavours that can come and go with this question. So, Huineng's an appropriate response. Well, not sorry, Huineng's, it was Yunmen's appropriate response, is rooted in two elements, we could say, wisdom and compassion. So the wisdom part is this uncertainty, this not knowing, this wide open awareness, receiving the whole moment. This sense that in that space there is a creative possibility where we have suspended our views and opinions, where we've let go of our habitual ways of perceiving and reacting to the moment, and where something new, unexpected and authentic might arise as a response. But this response is guided by our ethical values and compassion. It's very much rooted in that. And tomorrow morning I'll talk a lot more about how compassion is actually practiced and cultivated within the Korean Sun tradition. But what I'd like to draw out tonight is more about how compassion is an attitude that actually becomes the ground in this groundless life. It becomes our refuge. It's what we can trust on in terms of how we respond. It's a refuge we can seek in terms of actually trusting the authenticity of our response. So we have this twofold thing, this ethical value towards non-harming. And from this base of non-harming, we have this commitment to actually be a support for the happiness and well-being of all beings, of all life. And within this context, we could see compassion really as a shorthand for the four divine or sublime abodes. In Tibetan, they refer to them as the four immeasurables, what are known in the insight tradition as the Brahma Viharas. So loving kindness, appreciative joy, compassion and equanimity. And the root of this is goodwill or loving kindness. And we've really been emphasizing that in this retreat, that meeting our experience with this attitude of care, kindness, befriending, having a sense of goodwill or benevolence towards our experience. And this orientation of the mind, this attitude and quality of the heart, enables us to meet experience in a way that undermines our tendency towards aversion and ill will. They talk about in the tradition how when the heart is full of goodwill, of loving kindness, there's no room, there's no space for any ill will. So we start with this, from this basis of cultivating this sense of benevolence, of kindness to all life and to all experience. And when this meets the joy, the good fortune, the beauty of life, of the world, it blossoms as appreciative joy. We experience a sense of appreciation for and gratitude. There's a sense in how we participate in sharing the joy and the good fortune of others, the beauty of the world. And this can really become alive for a lot of us in nature. And that sense of joy that can arise in the natural world and from the beauty of the natural world. And there's a way in which, with this appreciative joy, we can tap into a sense of abundance, a sense of a world that is full of joy that we can tap into at any time, that can resource us. And this appreciative joy undermines any tendency we might have towards jealousy and envy, but also counteracts the difficulties around insufficiency or a sense of lack. When this heart inclined towards goodwill meets the distress, the pain, the suffering of the world, it flowers as compassion. And compassion, we could say, has two aspects. What we might call the passive aspect or the receptive aspect, and the active aspect. So this ability and this willingness to turn towards the distress, the pain, the suffering of another, to acknowledge it and really be present with it, to allow our hearts to resonate with the heart of the other. There's a sense in which we are able to imagine ourselves in their shoes, so we have this sense of connection with the other, a sense of non-separation. And there's this movement of empathy. And from this movement of empathy, there's this desire, this wish to alleviate the suffering of the other. And this then moves into a response, into action, into saying, doing, or just being with the other in a way that actually alleviates their suffering as best we can in the moment. And then these three qualities are held in the cool embrace of equanimity. This sense of balance, of stability, of peace, that stops us becoming overwhelmed. Overwhelmed by the enormity of suffering in the world, but also overwhelmed by the exuberance of joy in the world. So equanimity maintains that ability to be stable, the ability to be balanced in the midst of all life, the joyful and the difficult, the challenging and the beautiful. And what I'd like to do also is really add two other qualities that I think are really indispensable to this practice and to this sense of an appropriate response. And they are humility and forgiveness. So really being able to have that sense of our own limitations, both as an individual, what it is we're actually really capable of, but also as a human being. That in reality, we can never know all the conditions that are operating in any one moment. We can never be sure how our action, our response to the situation is going to work out. So having the humility to actually be okay with that, to be okay with our limitations, with the limitations of the moment, and still respond, still act. And that sense of forgiveness, self-forgiveness, for our shortcomings, for our mistakes, for not living up to our values and our ideals, for being human. And as we're able to recognise our own humility, our own limitations, and also extend this forgiveness to ourselves, we can also see how this can start to radiate out into the world, that we recognise the limitations of others. We forgive them their mistakes and their shortcomings. And I'd like to finish with a little quote that it was actually my partner gave me just before I went on a long retreat here at Gaia House. And it's from a teacher called Seng San. And he said, "True freedom is being without anxiety about imperfection." So this sense that we act in the moment as best we can, without being hindered by or overladen with these ideals of perfectionism, of paralysis by that type of thing, actually. I've certainly experienced that in my life, where wanting to do things something so perfectly stops me doing anything at all. And responding as best we can, regardless. And being okay with it being good enough. So, thank you for your kind attention. We have an opportunity now for any reflections, comments, anything that needs maybe clarification, anything that feels just there for you at this moment.
Could you give some guidance on how to deal compassionately with someone who has great expectations of you?
Sorry, with someone who has
great expectations of you? So, an example might be the Buddha leaving home and what his mother or father might say, or a partner who wants to be with you but really wants to move further on. How do you deal with that situation?
That is a challenging one. And I think that is the quandary all of us find when we're in relationships, about being authentic to our own selves and at the same time responding compassionately to the needs of another. I think listening, so this sense of listening that Catherine talked about today, so that we are able to really hear their concerns, their fears, their anxieties, and are able to then respond to that, if you like. Because often what we're more caught up with is our own needs, our own sense of what we want. And often the other person then feels unheard, unseen. So I think being able to really just listen is a good starting point. And from that point of listening, then finding that response that acknowledges what it is they've said, what their needs are, but also has this sense of authenticity about what it is you need within that as well. And there's a way in which, in the end, we can never fully take care of another person. We can never fully take care of another person's needs, that they hold some of the responsibility. In any moment, there's this co-creation of the moment through our experience and through their experience. And then there's the moment that arises out of that. And we can't control their side of it. We can meet it, we can respond to it, but we can't actually control it. And we, in the end, we can't take ultimate responsibility for it. But we can also voice, if we can get the dialogue going in such a way that they're feeling heard, that it might open up a space where they can hear us as well. And within that space then, we might be able to voice our needs in a way that they're also heard. And things then may start to move. I don't know if that helps, but...
Thank you. I'm interested in how you got over your perfectionism.
How I got over my...
Perfectionism.
I haven't. something like this. You know, being up here in front of all these people, and I think like many practitioners, you know, my tendency is to want to be a bit more quiet, a bit more in the background, more introverted. It can be a challenge, and of course part of that challenge is wanting to do the best talk that anybody's ever done before. a lot of it is just coming to terms with actually doing the best talk I can do in this moment, that it being good enough. And that's an ongoing process. I think my experience of it is that it's lessened in some areas of my life, and then I come into a new area like this and I find it arising anew in a different area. But I suppose there's a sense of understanding from the past that it changes, and there's also, through practice, a bit more stability, a bit more being able to be with that sense of wanting to do it perfectly, that sense of the imposter syndrome that can start to come up, and actually being able to hold that more. But whether we ever completely get over it, I don't know. Maybe if I ever do, I'll let you know.
being said, sometimes we do know. That's how we feel. Anyway, when we see someone harming someone else, we know. I mean, they have a few opinions. But they're harming someone. Mm.
Well, we may have that view and opinion, but we also have that view and opinion that actually an authentic or an okay response to that is to actually be aggressive, let's say. And that may not be the most appropriate. So letting go of views and opinions is not a... letting go of discernment. We're still rooted very much in an ethical and a compassionate framework. So like I kind of finished the talk, the other side of this whole wisdom aspect of uncertainty, of the parking, if you like, of our views and opinions, is also that it's grounded by, it's guided by compassion, it's guided by ethics. So we still are called to respond in that case. We're still called to actually have a definite no, this is not okay. That what you're doing is causing harm. But how we actually meet them in doing that still requires that kind of letting go of habits of perception, of reactivity, of certainty about how things should be, so that we can actually meet that person in a way that actually has a possibility of bringing about some change. So if we meet a person who's being angry and aggressive and harming another person with anger and aggression, the chances are what we'll do is we'll escalate the situation. Whereas if we can meet them from that space where actually we're not judging the, how would I put it? We're not judging the background from which it's coming, let's say, because that other person may have their own legitimate views and opinions, but they're just acting them out in a way that's actually harmful. So if we can address their views and opinions in a way that actually acknowledges them and actually finds common ground, then we may be able to change what's going on. So there's also a sense as well that this this thing around views and opinions isn't that we shouldn't have any views and opinions. You know, we kind of navigate our way in the world through views and opinions. But it's much more about, for me, the questions would be not so much what are people's views and opinions, but how tightly do you hold to a view and opinion? How identified are you with it? And what's the outcome of the view and opinion? Does it cause harm, or does it lead to compassion and wisdom? So for me, it's not really so much about don't have any views and opinions. It's actually about parking them as much as about an investigation of the views and opinions, and not holding to them tightly, and if you like, trying to let go of the ones that are harmful and actually cultivate the ones that lead to wisdom and to compassion. And in a sense, you know, talking here about cultivating uncertainty and wonder and mystery is a view and an opinion. You know, we can't really escape from that. But it's a way of viewing the world, it's a way of perceiving the world that can actually lead to compassion and to wisdom and to a better life for all than many other views and opinions we might have. Thank you. Okay, so we'll have a period of walking meditation. If you want to put your sitting stuff back in place, and then we can stand up.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.